You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. I have three poets stepping up to the mic tonight. I'm very pleased to present two Sonoma County poets, Jody Hoddle and Marjorie Stein. Joining them is New York poet Lee Slonimski. But we're going to start off with Jody Hoddle. Sonoma County poet Jody Hoddle, H-O-T-T-E-L, recently won the 2012 Blue Light Poetry Prize for her chapbook, Heart Mountain, published by Diane Frank's Blue Light Press in San Francisco. The title refers to the internment camp in Wyoming, where between the years 1942 and 1945, over 110,000 Japanese Americans were imprisoned after being forcibly removed from their homes. This shameful page from American history was the result of the bombing of Pearl Harbor and our nation's subsequent panic leading to President Franklin Roosevelt's executive order authorizing these, quote, military zones. When Hoddle's mother was 16 years of age, she was incarcerated along with her family at Heart Mountain, one of over 14,000 Americans, Japanese Americans, held there by the time it closed in 1945. So welcome, Jody Hoddle. I'm really glad you could make it here today to share your poems.
Thank you, Catherine.
I have known several people who were in Nazi concentration camps, and although they shared their experiences with me as a friend, it was obvious that they didn't discuss much with their own family members. Often they, too, had been through enough, and they didn't want to bring more misery into mm-hmm. their lives. But there were other reasons, too. Did your mother share much of her internment history with you?
No, in a word. But there was a high school yearbook that always sat on the end table in our living room, and I would leaf through it, and I saw that my mother had been in a camp. But everybody in the pictures in the yearbook obviously were smiling, looked happy, and when I tried to talk to my mother about it, she talked about how much fun it was. And so I knew that there was something else going on. I didn't get much information. As it turns out, I later found out, though, that for a teenager, that was actually a fairly typical feeling because they had a great sense of freedom being in the camps as opposed to living at home on the farm where they had to work really hard. And they had a lot of friends and mm-hmm. social activities there. So she wasn't entirely lying. She just wasn't telling me the whole truth.
Right. She was kind of sharing the good part of it.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, they did have all kinds of things set up in these internment camps mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. for the people. But the bottom line is there were guard towers and barbed wire.
Right.
So
and no freedom.
Yeah. Yeah mm-hmm. Kind of takes away from that. A good experience.
Mm-hmm.
So Heart Mountain is such an ironic name for
yes.
an internment camp. Mm-hmm. But before camps like Heart Mountain were constructed, Japanese Americans, the majority of them that were born in this country, were kept in places like the horse stalls at the old Tan Foran racetrack in San Bruno.
Right.
Where was your mother and her family first sent?
They were sent from basically the eastern end of the state of Washington in the Yakima Valley to Portland, Oregon, and they called it the Portland Assembly Center, which is a euphemism, but I found out later that it was actually a stockyard, and one of my poems is about that.
Well, we could spend a couple of hours easily talking about mm-hmm. this history, but let's do turn to your poems now. Here is Jody Hoddle reading from her chapbook, Heart Mountain.
Thank you. The poems are roughly in a chronological order, and this first poem is called Unwritten Note, and I was completely astounded to learn that there were veterans of World War I who were incarcerated during World War II in internment camps. And I had read about this man, Hideo Murata, who was a veteran of World War I, and rather than enter an internment camp, he committed suicide and did not leave a note. So this piece is an imagined note that he might have written. Unwritten note. The news is on everyone's lips, like flies gathering on excrement. President Roosevelt has ordered our removal. Will we be taken from our homes like vermin? I know it must be a misunderstanding, gossip spread in these harsh times. I choke on acrid laughter. It is not possible. After all, I served my chosen country in the army in the Great War. So I go to see my longtime friend and sheriff of Monterey County. It is no joke, Hideo. You'll have to go. He can't look me in the eyes. When he finds my body hung in this rented room with my certificate of honorary citizenship expressing honor and respect for your loyal and splendid service to the country, he will understand why I could not allow this noble country to tarnish its honor or mine. Okay, this next piece is based on a photograph I have of my mother and a little neighbor girl, and they're actually sitting on a pile of watermelons. Her parents were truck farmers. And the date on the photo is September 1941, and I was moved to write this piece because it was heartbreaking to think that in just a few months, her whole life would be on a different course. Photograph, September 1941. Perched on a pile of watermelons, thumping hard, almost bursting. I'm bursting too, 16, brown from work in the fields, beaming at our family's harvest. My arm cradles Amy, our five-year-old neighbor, with straight bangs and frilly kerchief. We smile for the camera. In less than 3 months, the bombs at Pearl Harbor explode our lives. By spring, our family is imprisoned in a remote desert. 2 years later, I leave my parents behind to go to college, carrying this photo in my wallet and the dry taste of dust in my mouth. I never return home, never see Amy again. I still crave watermelons. Remember their sweetness. So not all the pieces in this book are based on incidents with my mother or memories of my mother's. And that's true of this piece. There's a very common saying, gaman, in Japanese, that means to bear the seemingly unbearable with dignity and patience. And when Executive Order 9066 was posted, ordering people to leave, they only had a very short time, a week or two, to deal with their belongings and were told to take only what they could carry. And that's what this poem's about. Come on. It's impossible to pack 3 decades of married life in 2 suitcases. How do I choose what to carry into uncertainty? The notice nailed to the telephone pole orders us to bring bedding, plates and utensils, clothing, tells us cameras, radios, and our dog Rusty aren't allowed. I'll wear my Sunday dress, hat and coat over a couple of house dresses, pack my gray sweater, nightgown, unmentionables, find room for my Bible, our wedding portrait, and tuck in dignity, patience, gaman. Okay, this next piece was told to me by one of my mom's friends that I met. Her name's Marjorie Matsushita Sperling. And she told me about the day they left their home and got on the train to go to Portland to the assembly center. It seems that that train ride left an indelible mark on most of these people. It's the thing they come back to over and over again. So this is based on the story she told me. It's called Evacuation Day, June 5th, 1942. At an empty station beside the train tracks, quiet gleam. It's dusk, the in-between time of a warm June evening. With brakes screeching, a truck skids to the stop at a platform, spilling out young soldiers, rifles slung over their backs, drunkenly shoving each other, shattering a window pane in the station. With a hiss, a black train creeps in. Silent, the Japanese families approach, dressed in their Sunday best. Numbered and tagged, they line up to board, heavy with what they are allowed to carry. Throughout the night, the train carries its freight from their Yakima Valley homes to an unknown future. Soldiers order shades drawn, parade the aisles, point rifles, as though their weary prisoners could escape. Pulling into the stockyard, the train's shriek signals arrival. But still in darkness, the cargo hears only the clang of the closing gates. Okay, the next one is about a different so-called assembly center at Tanforan, which is near the San Francisco airport. And actually, I found out recently that there's a BART station there now. And it was a racetrack. And a lot of the people who were evacuated from Berkeley ended up there. So this is called Tanforan Assembly Center, 1942, San Bruno. To escape the squeeze of quarters hung with sheets for privacy, I join hundreds circling the racetrack, our scuffing feet obscuring hoofprints from racehorses that used to pace this endless oval. Ahead, my little sister Midori and her friend Fumiko bend their heads close to whisper secrets as if still strolling the halls of high school. I pass our old neighbors, Mr. and Mrs. Fujita, who shuffle slowly with newfound leisure, rekindling memories, sharing the weight of worries. I climb to the top of the grandstand, high above day-to-day grief. In the corner, the Shimizu brothers roll a game of dice. Mr. Morita meditates next to a man stretched out asleep on a bench. My eyes skim above the barracks and barbed wire, follow trains rumbling in the distance, planes glinting overhead, to the outline of foothills that remind me of our Berkeley home, only a few miles away, beyond reach. The next poem I'm going to read is what's called a haibun, which is a blended genre, which is part prose poem and part haiku. And it's based on a piece of art, a lino cut by Henry Sugimoto, a Japanese-American artist. He was an artist before the camp and continued in the camp and after. And I was really taken by this black and white piece of art that he did. Letter to a Nisei Soldier, 1944, after a lino cut by Henry Sugimoto. The baby squirms in my arms, but I am far away with you. So much I want for you to return from Italy to meet Sumio, your son, for this constant gritty wind to cease, the suffocating heat to stop, to look out the window and not see a guard tower glaring at me, to have our two-month-old son grow up free as an American should. The face of a sunflower has climbed to our window, yes, from the seeds you planted before shipping out. I tend it as though it has the power to keep you alive. Its face greets me each morning like Sumi's. He looks just like you. Two faces full of life. Night in Amachi, beyond guard towers, barbed wire, flickering desert sky. I wanted to mention, in case people don't know, that once the government had people in the camps, they decided that they needed more soldiers, and so they did create a draft and drafted people out of the camps where they left behind, in this case, their wife and unborn child at the time, and sometimes their parents were left behind barbed wire. Okay, this next piece is about getting toward the closing of the camps. And as I just said, a lot of men were drafted out of the camps. A lot of other people, younger people mostly, left to go to colleges in the Midwest and the East if they were sponsored, or to jobs in the Midwest and the East. And it left basically the very, very young and the older people behind. And this poem imagines an older couple getting ready to leave the camps. They basically got kicked out in a way because they had nowhere to return to. It's called Sweeping. Our battered suitcases stand by the door, but they will have to wait while I sweep the desert dust one last time. 3 years we've lived behind barbed wire. Now, Papa and I are being forced out, too old for farming, no home to go back to, our children already gone. Sam to war in Europe, a college in Chicago for May. I pause in the doorway of the barrack, our only shelter from the bitter winds, searing heat. No need for a last look at the sentinel of Heart Mountain. It will never be far enough away that I can't see it. I shove the broom hard into empty corners, shaping neat piles of sand. Papa chides, "Why clean?" But I don't listen. Whoever comes to demolish these empty walls will see. We Japanese kept our homes clean. Okay, for the final piece, I think this one may be self-explanatory. I'm just going to read it. It's called Shikataganai. Shikataganai means it can't be helped, which translates scour and scrub till the smell of horse urine is a faint memory. Cobble a table out of scavenged fruit crates. Create a home from the stall that is temporary shelter for your family of six. Pretend you don't see barbed wire or soldiers with rifles and guard towers when you gaze at Heart Mountain on the horizon. Shikataganai, a tacit agreement to adopt the government jargon, relocation and internment, not concentration or prison camp. To be as American as possible, having to prove your loyalty even though you were born here. And when your daughter hungers to know about your life in camp, you giggle about the hijinks girls and being prom queen, a typical teenage life. It suggests your secret mounting dread each year as December 7th approaches, even now, over 60 years later. Shikataganai means end of discussion. I don't want to talk about it. There's nothing more to say.
Thank you so much, Jody. This is really an important collection. It's a small collection, and it speaks volumes. So thank you so much for reading those. What would you like people to take away with them after reading your poems or hearing them?
Well, I spoke to someone this morning who said that she had attended one of my readings and said that she left feeling sad and angry. And I don't know that I necessarily want people to be sad and angry, but I want to move them in some way to realize that the freedoms we have in this country are not to be taken for granted. They need to be safeguarded.
Absolutely.
Our civil liberties.
Yeah, good, because we know how history tends to repeat itself. Mm-hmm. And there are people on the planet right now, in our country right now, who are harassed because they may not, quote, look like they were born in America, but they were. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all craziness. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's good. So I know you plan to travel to Heart Mountain in August for a multi-generation pilgrimage. You'll also read your poems there. What are your expectations and hopes for this trip?
I just hope I don't start crying.
I think it would be okay if you do.
Yeah, it'll be wonderful to read the poems and actually see Heart Mountain in the distance. It has a very unique shape, very iconic shape, and to be there and remember my mother. Do it in memory of her.
Excellent. Thank you again.
Thank you.
We're going to move on to some more poetry in just a few minutes, but first, it's June, and if you're anything like me, you're getting a little itchy for some vacation. So let's close our eyes just for a few minutes and go to Hawaii. This is Ka Loke, sung by the Makaha Sons with Dennis Pavao.
Oh,
aloha, we are back. Next up is New York poet Lee Slonimsky. He's going to be reading from his two newest collections, Money and Light, and the very beautiful Logician of the Wind. Here is Lee Slonimsky.
This is Money and Light, the title poem from the collection of the same name. Clouds speak a language of light, you told me, translated easily enough with a pair of cheap binoculars, glasses of wine, and a day off from work on this windy porch, hammock suspended, rocking with the slow of forever in 2 p.m.'s quiet glow. Fancy dreams, I couldn't help thinking, for this run-down hilly street in the north and west of Catskill, where money always drifts south. But today I heard the speech of bulbous, wide-tailed cumulus to wisps of cirrus. You translated it with an odd perfection, cloud rolling, basso profundo lilting in your gentle, high-pitched hum. And I saw the way the afternoon sun flashed here and there, hieroglyphs of glow, softly staining embankments of puff, moisture's muscle, intimate grays and whites, the flesh and bone of fog and drizzle, the only letters the sky ever writes, money melted to light. Autumn at the foot of Blue Mountain. Alone among the red and orange leaves coming down is a leaf marked like a seashell, as if a geologic bookmark was moved suddenly from the time when all the earth was underwater, moved into the late day shimmer of cloud-marbled sky. We marvel at the closeness of chlorophyll and calcium, even as a hawk above merges with the surge of wind and feathery soar, even as the line between autumn and winter blurs in the spin of leaves like huge tinted snowflakes slowly floating down. Last time we hiked this path, we faced a sun so bright it bronzed yellow birch leaves, tinted granite gold. Now we stare instead at shadows and frost. Somewhere in the distance, a barred owl hoots. Horse. A billion years ago or more, we split. One branch of DNA became the plants, the other animals, amoeba, ants, eventually us with all our wars and wit. And so this gnarled old oak should not surprise, its massive knot a perfect horse's head, such natural craftsmanship. Both branches wed in a quaint sculpture, yet exact and wise in summary of science. But the snort you hear quite suddenly, flapping of tails, unnerve, then stomp of hooves truly startles. It conjures wind and gallop, courage, heart. Whatever's in there yearns so to be free, you want to liberate it from this tree. Fusion. Trees are the scholars of biology. No doctorates or fellowships or robes, but intuition, perspicacity. Yet earth is riddled with so many woes and trials, potential deep calamities, like asteroid collisions, sun's demise. No refuge either in noon sunny breeze or twinkling stars to come. Those are mere lies of sparkle, shimmer. Fusion is their core. That same which threatens our farewell in war. But here we'll laze our heads back in the grass and let trees lecture us on sway and balm. Our now so swiftly merges with the past while leafy scholars talk of love and calm. Seaside Bench, Sorrento. When Wilhelmina F. Jastrzemski found Vesuvius had outlined some ghost roots of trees beneath the lava-sheeted ground, empty spaces traced with pebbles, Missing truths of leaf and bark species were brought to light. Her plaster cast could resurrect the dead, at least as sculpture, art. And now the flight of seahawks hints at pterodactyl blood, while ancient sunlight shimmers on the bay, and our thoughts turn to love, which if it lasts a year will flirt with immortality. Vesuvius has nothing new to say. Hey, shrouded calm, this all goes by so fast. There's more than one kind of catastrophe. John Robin, botanist to the French king, 1602. Voluptuous these trees that bask in May. Just weeks ago their nudity was stark. Twigs, branches spearing pale late winter air as if defending pulse from freeze. The stare, caresses that he gives an oak display an ardor only half human. The bark excites him so, and oh, those supple roots. He lusts for lush, this royal botanist, who sublimates his urges in clenched fists, whose blushes mirror pink rose dawn. There stirs so deep within his half-green, trembling heart a different ancestry. It lulls, then roars. Its sap veins, soaked with ancient chlorophyll, and speaks to him of time immemorial. Widow in the Woods. 100 years or more, she's bent her crown. In storm, in sun, in moon-splashed midnight breeze, surviving all the random vagaries of this harsh world. A dense twigged veil drifts down from crown along her trunk, mourning slow wood that rustles tattered in a hint of wind this January dusk, cloudy, purpling the ground with sudden shadows. How she broods on dark surprise and loss, alone these many years, despondent, bent, her bolt-cracked mate transformed to splinters, moss. Though not alone, you feel the sadness of a twilight breeze. There's never enough love. The widow nods to you. Her branches moan.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. This is Catherine Hastings. Let's return now to Lee Slonimski.
Wind. This hilltop pawns a well-schooled sorcerer in conjuring of fir trees, wispy clouds from green and crystal depths. Pythagoras, distressed by senses imperfection, broods on how closely the trees below reflect their cousin's spearing sky. And now, were he to put his hand in water, it would merge with branches in a shimmering mirage. He wonders if the eye's bold lies, matter, misleading as slow morning's trickery of light and water, are meant to instruct him in raw solitude. Then sudden chill, one fleeting breeze makes mirror into blur. Beyond the intellect, there's nature's will. This is The Sycamores of Rome by Carol Goodman, which appears in Money and Light by Lee Slonimski. These sycamores' bark peels in the delicate shades of Quattrocento fresco. One tree's trunk is as pale as honeydew rind, scraped in places to reveal the watery green fruit inside. They remind you of the sycamores in Rome and how their leaves swirled in the dusk-bright Tiber and papered the rain-corroded haunches of Garibaldi's horse in the park at the top of the Janiculum, where women, still soft-eyed from siesta, strolled arm in arm above the many-breasted city. You could compare the color of their leaves to the bricks that wall the road, uncoiling down the hill, or the rust dusting slim hips of boys tilting backwards in fountains. But what you remember is a single arrow of sun shooting through Latin class to strike the studiously bent head of your fellow scholar, setting dull brown hair into flames of Titian red, so that you stumbled over your Virgil translation, losing the measure of your own heart's beat. The next day, you crested the hill on your way to mail a letter at the Vatican and found that the bronze-clad sky had split open to let in the Apennines, standing sentinel above the winter-besieged city. On your last morning, you went back to the park on top of the hill, but weather had already done what failing memory never would, wound the thick white wool of fog like a sheet tangled in sleep-sprawled limbs around the achingly fine bones of your lost, beloved city.
That was Lise Linimsky reading from Money and Light and Logician of the Wind. Up next is Sonoma County poet Marjorie Stein. She has a new book out, An Atlas of Lost Causes, which was published by Kelsey Street Press in Berkeley. Is it one long poem? Is it a novella? Is it a murder mystery? You tell me. I think one of the things I like so very much about this book is that you cannot put it in one little box. Here now is Marjorie Stein.
Hello, everybody. I'm going to read from my first and only book, An Atlas of Lost Causes. It's pretty deeply personal in a way, and yet it may not be conceived as such by people who know me. So it's a little bit masked in some level, but again, very deeply personal. So it's written in several sections, and I'll just start reading a little bit of it. Dear sister, I've moved into your room, held hands up to the light. At this angle, secretly outlining the shape of a gangster's heart, any shadow can thrill the mind. Vowing to capture the rapid eye movements of my crimes, your crimes, someone will take a bullet. How should the skin tear when cut? You'd be surprised, but it takes a long time to break something properly. What is true usually happens too fast. Paper constructions of a town on fire crease the afternoon, latticed by the polarized light. A woman may beg your pardon and collapse, engulfed. A stranger realizes it's a perfect day and leaps to cover each lumen with her own body, while an entire galaxy of broken glass moves through her nerves. Heaven is not what you think. No velvet zenith. More like the animal pain of mothers arriving at polished walls. Prayers, wasted, turn fingers into weeds in the downed day. More evidence that stars are just dead light, falling behind schedule. You know, a lot of what this is for me is a real fascination with physics, and how our world is not at all what we think it is. So there's a lot that the physicists tell us that happens that we just can't conceive of. You know, the fact that there's a probability that I could put my finger through this wall, but chances are it will never happen. And yet it's a possible thing. On a warm day, the view from the Marin Headlands above the Golden Gate Bridge is suggestive. Bolts are not bolts. Steel is not steel. The paint is chronically applied to stand in for precious metals. They say some camera captured 14 suicides in 1 year. They say each act appeared so offhand. Maybe it isn't hard to leave a place after all. Just a shift in weight over a verge, and the act completes itself. A verticality leans toward closure. Quite a bit of this, too, is pulled from news headlines and current events, and it's a way of, you know, I feel like I'm kind of writing around something, trying to understand the terrible beauty of the world. And, you know, this section about the suicides on the bridge, you know, many of you probably know there is a documentary about that, and it's something I can't bring myself to watch, but yet there's this fascination of, you know, the line between sanity and insanity, and where do you cross that line into a desperate act? It's a pretty fine line, I think. So let me go on to section two, rehearse your identity. Some people may consider today good funeral weather. The earth's very cold, clamps itself to bone, and won't let go. Standing near anything on fire, even one's own home, has a certain animal appeal on days like this. You, my twin, the normally off, have fused the coldest month of the calendar into terrible verbs, immaculate blows to the bone. This is where spheres, those bubbles of oily light, usually leave the scene in groups of odd numbers. So there's a thread that you've probably gathered by now of a twin running throughout this book, and it's kind of an inquiry into what is self, you know, where does self end and where do others begin? And this concept of a twin is kind of trying to look at that, trying to, you know, I certainly don't have an answer, and I was curious, which is part of the reason why I wrote this. They say that real life has no plot. They say that Muybridge's horses have annihilated time and space. Now we have film. We have noir. Shot-by-shot motion was stolen, then stitched into a ribbon. True momentum arises by pondering reality with a lit fuse. Any scene can come apart in our hands. The stricken sense that every word must be tied to an idea. The familiar yellow when things go terribly wrong. Excuse me. Nobody knows what will determine our swerve into the splendid. Rehearse your identity. Slow eye outlines the body chalked on hard stones. A face not yet, and arms emptied. What ripped you over the edge? One dusty wonder flattened, then exploded. Grainy twilight moan, the moon's soft curve. You fall, a holy alone. And section three, memory theater. My sister is a woman caught in the epoch between the industrial age and the information age. She sits in a darkened cell. I must hurry, she thinks aloud. Ellipses fill in the pauses. She doesn't want the sun in her eyes. I'm expecting someone, she says to the wall. Don't know if he still wears that halo. He doesn't exactly photograph well. You know, slow film speeds, faulty shutters, shaky hands. Her hands trail off, massaging shapes out of flat air. Why, she wonders, does everything within a confined space seek to reach the same ambient temperature? What I really want to know, she says, is are things getting better or are they getting worse? Sell my bones, she begs me. I'm done with pulling them around. Maybe they will make a structure of sound by interrupting winds. This is the likely outcome of the sun favoring one hill over another, and the heated air rushes in to fill the vacuum. White and crystallized, or bleached and dense, to be ground into inks and presented as pitiful letters to God. Another time we'll find rest in a narrow box. Ritualizing human remains has put sorrow into our mouths, and we learn that bodies, broken down, and bones hollowed out by grief have invented a music to fill the wreck. We love for the bones to go on without us. Look, noon will come anyway. Let's carve our initials in our ribs, questioning anatomy with blades between our teeth. It's closer now, and you can level it in your open palm, just after twilight. Annihilation mistakes have happened before. Look in the mirror. When a breeze pirouettes, it is too beautiful to photograph. We can only see its imprint on branches and our hair, lifted so tenderly as we turn our faces toward the caress. It's too beautiful to hold in our hands. That scatter of sensations leaves us gasping, as if it were the first time, the last time. Standing on lava beds, molten rock, liquid bone of earth on fire, the crescendo into a black Pacific night. Our primitive brain startled into refractions as the breeze bends around our frail bodies into exponential winds, too reluctant to count. And this next section is called Mine is an Atlas of Lost Causes. Again, a lot of this is kind of a mashup of little bits of things I picked up from my childhood and dreams. And a lot of it, I think, like most poets and writers and artists in general, you don't know where it comes from. You know, it's one of those things where I feel like I can't take full credit for any of this, because it feels like, you know, you sit down to do the work and you just have to be open and something surprising will come out of it. So that's why I write, because it's so much fun. You never know what will happen. So I will read a few paragraphs out of this section. I intend to inventory my sister's possessions. I don't know if there will be a trial soon. The thought exhausts me, wrung out. The photos, are they really our family, or did she buy them at a flea market? Who would sell photos of their dead? I wish I had a lorgnette to frame my view, one eye round and miniaturized as I confront the unstable. Difficult streets where two beings collide unequally, where the energy of all reactions is dissipated as heat, light, and regret. I am expecting these streets to behave like overexposed film, ghostly haloing, erasing the detail, stains the action into a flattened print. Mine is an atlas of lost causes. It is a relief to let go of hope. Its absence may allow the infinite to move in, where each wish can find its perfect candle to blow out. And this little paragraph here, again, it's another one of those very bizarre things that I picked up on the news, and who knows if it's true or not, but it's just so strange that I just had to include it. Canada's gravitational pull is weaker than the rest of the world's. I could never make up something like this. The world becomes less predictable day by day. And the fifth section is called Urgent Mountain. And little bits in here are a little bit more concrete in terms of trying to tell a story. I'm in a motel room. The cop led me here. We're at the foot of an urgent mountain. How many towns have such an embrace for the eyes? Each direction, hinged upon her rocky shoulders, pushing aside the sky. The motel room is anonymous, milky cold, white, disinfected. the mattress covered in plastic beneath the bedding. It is shocking how many ways a body can leak fluid. Language can be said to kill the body. An interview seen as pinning a specimen down. Counterfeit, surfeit, albeit. A reason for children running in twos. Polaris, bipolar explanation of a planet's orb. Can be derived by mathematics. A formula of sidereal motion, twined by elliptical periods. When is a day, a year, a star bursting forth? And all the universe or monoverse is magnetized, merely a product of friction between opposites. She, my twin, used to think she was the heaviest object in the universe, gravitational centerfold. And section 6, you may borrow a revolver as a substitute for the future. I followed my sister the day before day zero. I've never told anyone this before. She sat at the bus stop, appearing to be from out of town, talking to strangers hypnotically. Music from two different sources converged at the bus stop. Urban trip-hop from a trendy bar, and urbane classical intended to dissuade teenagers from enjoying the public square. What have I learned from this trespass? That some forms of music cannot be overdubbed. That my sister has always had enough to eat, until now. She carried a banjo without a case. I never knew she played. Perhaps she doesn't, but it was effective as a conversation piece with strangers. They were undoubtedly curious. I slipped into the deep shadow of an ancient verge, contradicting impulses. I wanted to flee. I wanted to reel in the distance. What I mean to say is, I wanted to grab the banjo from her hand and level a look at her. Cheap shoes. Her ankles wobbled. Why should I be embarrassed for her? I felt like the last surviving member of my tribe. I knew from the geometry of her posture that my sister was lost. The edges of the sky, the dirt of the dusty street, blur. The grammar of a disintegration. This was like a garroting, one by one. But it was her one body, slim and fading, and yet coiled tight. She was in danger, yet I did nothing. The bus arrived, smog, throttling gears. She, the stranger, and the banjo were gone. I must say it, swallowed. I approached someone remaining behind and asked if he had spoken to the woman with the banjo. He sliced a fraction of quiet, then said, "Look, lady, I don't know what you were talking about." My whole body felt inert, one of the noble gases incapable of forming compounds. Every first word I ever learned broke off from my mind. The composition paper, coarse tree bark, the pencil, fat and dull. And a smear up of the alphabet ensued. I'm 5 years old again, writing Dear God letters on the back of my handwriting assignment. The mirrored D's and B's bleeding through. Dear God, please make Sam stop biting Dad before Dad takes him out to the orchard and bullets him in the head. So that last sentence was really difficult for me to leave in here because it's actually based on something that happened when I was a teenager, and we had an old family mutt, and his name was Sam, and he was a very old arthritic mutt, and I grew up in the cold Midwest, and it was winter, and the poor dog was arthritic and deaf, and he didn't like being in the house. So my dad did the humane thing and took him out to the orchard and tried to euthanize him in the way he knew how. And he told me later that was the most difficult thing he'd ever had to do in his life. And I knew that. And yet I'm writing from the perspective of somebody who doesn't get that. And this was really hard for me to leave this in the book and have my dad read this. And yet, you know, I talked to my mom about it and my sisters, and they all thought at first it was horrible that I had this in here. But I explained to them my intention. So, you know, a lot of writing, I think, is about kind of exposing things and coming out. And a lot of this is like coming out again, like coming out as a lesbian. Now I'm coming out as as a poet, which is an interesting process. Anyway, Dad, if you're listening, I love you a lot, and I understand what happened here. So let me pick up a few more little sections here. By the time everything is revealed, I will be mid-flight, far above the family tree, brazenly stealing sleep, no longer the lonely one compelled to count offenses. They say square waves stand for time, but where do we draw the line? The chief of police is at my door. In a binary world, I am either on or off. Here or not here. She is knocking on the door. Street reflecting off the chrome. They say everything we experience comes to us as reflected light. I have temporarily run the course of material obsessions and am spinning to a stop. I unlatch the door. Crack open the door. My eyes flattened. Wallpaper gaze. I wanted, I think, something of yours to touch. She is casual, smiling. The cop wants to know why I've been following her. Everything all right? One decides with each tick of the clock, yes or no. They say the human race came this close to erasure. I feel my face go hot. I want to ask about the case, but no words form. The murder case. But she has already turned with a backward wave. I'm thinking of the Easter pilgrimage to Chimaya, New Mexico. I may go next year with the cross, a large wooden cross. And I'm going to skip ahead to the last section, which is called Oaring into a Blinding Star. Everyone has an iridescent death of her own, lingering in winter hands. Dear nothing, I am dreaming you are me. Shrouds of noise, then the photographer's glass turns a space into a perfect hush. Her lines are so short, but a different sky has been calling me. I walked to your room this morning in the pink dawn. Another day arrives as if nothing has happened. The police tape is gone. I'm a liar next to this. Reef of flags sewn for wooden boxes. But the house appeared to be occupied. Lamps, dogs, and humans breathing in and out. 9 gray trees no longer in the yard. A lone face, pixelated in a shaft of light, swims before the window. A fossilized illumination hallows the ground. I look at my left hand, fingers blurred with grime. A meager sun limps into the angle of day. I turn up my collar and walk on toward the body of water. And thank you very much for your interest in poetry.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you have been listening to Marjorie Stein reading from her book, An Atlas of Lost Causes.
I want to thank her and my other two poets featured on tonight's program, Jody Hoddle, author of Heart Mountain, and New York poet Lee Slonimski, who read from Money and Light and Logician of the Wind. Now it's time for you to grab your calendars and a pen, because I want you to know that on Saturday, July 14th at 7 p.m., the Word Temple Poetry Series will be introducing you to Alicia Ostricker. She is coming all the way from New England to read for this series. She will be reading from two books, The Book of Life, Selected Jewish Poems, 1979 to 2011. This is a brand new collection. It explores her emotional journey as a Jewish woman in a shaken society and her will to find strength through words. She will also be reading from No Heaven. These are just two books of her 14 poetry collections. She has received the Patterson Poetry Prize, the William Carlos Williams Award, and all kinds of other awards. And she has been the finalist for the National Book Award twice. So again, that is Saturday, July 14th at 7 p.m. at the Word Temple Poetry Series, which takes place at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts in Sebastopol. Appearing with Ostricker will be Joan Baranow, a Marin County poet. If you'd like more information, you can go to wordtemple.com, and you can also contact me. If you have any questions or comments about tonight's show, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope to see you on July 14th.